I got seven women on my mind. Four that want to own me, two that want to stone me, one says she's a friend of mine. Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Stand. Take it easy. Well, I'm standing on a corner in Winslow, Arizona, and such a fine sight to see. It's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford, slowing down to take a look at me. Come on, baby. Don't say
of course, and Take It Easy, exactly 10:30 on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. And that record is one of many that the man we're about to speak to was very heavily involved with, to say the least. The list that this man has worked with is incredible. The Beatles, the Stones, Led Zeppelin, The Who, Small Faces, The Kinks, Eric Clapton, Neil Young, Paul McCartney, and The Eagles, amongst many others. I am delighted and very, very proud to welcome onto the show Glyn Johns. Good morning, Glyn.
Good morning to you.
Listeners will know that I had a little bit of a career in music, but Glyn, you've been one of my idols for years, so I'm delighted we managed to get you on the show, and delighted you managed to write a book after all this time.
Yeah, no more delighted than I am. I'm glad to have got it over and done with, yes.
I was just telling you there off-air that we have a slight thing in common, that you kind of started back at a studio in Portland Place in London called IBC, which I think you described as one of the best studios in Europe. And I was fortunate enough to work in that very same studio years later when it was owned by Jet Records.
That's extraordinary. I had no idea that Jet Records ever owned IBC.
Yes.
In fact, I wish I didn't know now.
Was it number 35, Portland Place? Is
number
that right?
Number 35, exactly right.
There we go.
I went by there the other day for the first time in years, and the building looks exactly the same from the front.
I think it's an embassy or something now.
Maybe. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Could be. Now, a great place to start, and one of the first records you engineered was The Kinks, You Really Got Me, and All Day and All of That. Not a bad start, Glyn, to be fair.
No, not at all. No, it's very good, very interesting. Extraordinary period of time, really.
Yeah.
I'd engineered lots of records before that, but that was one of the first that made a big dent, I think.
You, of course, were also a musician before that, and I was staggered to discover in my research that you... Did you have a hit in Spain?
Yes.
Tell us about it, Glyn.
Well, it's pretty strange, really. But Bill Wyman and I started a production company very early on in the Stones' career, and Bill and I became friends, and we signed a band called The End, and... they were very aptly named, and we couldn't get them arrested in the United Kingdom, so they had a friend in Spain who knew a couple of guys who owned a company in Spain that wanted to start a record company, and so I went to Spain to sell the record we'd made with The End to this lot, and that was fruitful. We signed the deal, and as I was leaving, they asked me if I had anything else. Well, I had made a cover of a song that I'd cut with the Rolling Stones originally, called Lady Jane, and I went in and cut it a few weeks after I'd recorded it with the Rolling Stones with Tony Meehan, the drummer from the Shadows, who was introducing me, and it was really good, actually. We did a really good version of it and with a string quartet, and Brian Jones came in and played sitar on it, and John Mark played guitar. It was really good.
Wow.
Anyway, the few days after we'd cut it, we found out that someone else had cut it, and they'd already got it on Ready, Steady, Go, so we were lunched, really, because we'd been beaten to the post, basically.
Oh,
so
dear.
I had a copy of the acetate of this record in my briefcase when I was visiting these gentlemen in Spain, and I thought, well, here's an opportunity to maybe get Tony Meehan his money back. So I, long story short, I sold the record to them and got it was 120 quid or something, I don't know, in advance, which was what the session had cost in those days.
Yeah.
Returned to England very pleased with myself, thinking I got Tony his money back, and thought no more about it.
Yeah, funny.
And went to Spain 3 or 4 months later with Bill to promote the band The End going there, and only to got off the plane, only to discover I was told that my record was number one. I don't actually know if it was number one, but it was certainly in the top 10 somewhere.
Well,
which
I'm
probably
impressed.
Maybe sold 3 records or something in Spain.
I'm very impressed, Glyn. Local legend, then, clearly. Yeah, brilliant.
For about 2 minutes. It was interesting to be on the other side of it for a minute.
I bet it was, absolutely.
Now, for me, you are a producer and engineer's proper producer and engineer. I mean, you've been doing it since the good old days, and so many people look up to you because you do it properly. You make things sound amazing. When you started as an engineer and you were thrown into your kind of first sessions, where did the knowledge come from? Was it learning on the job?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
From the very first day I started in 1959, I was put straight onto a session as a junior, and... That was how it worked in those days.
Mm.
You were thrown in the deep end, and I was fortunate enough to watch some pretty amazing engineers doing their thing. As I said, as you mentioned earlier, the studio happened to be the best in Europe, in my opinion, easily the best in Europe. And so it attracted some pretty amazing clients, and obviously, as a result, had also extremely good staff working for it. And so I got to learn off the best, really.
Were those days still the days where engineers were expected to wear white lab coats, or had they those days gone then?
Well, no, actually, the maintenance guys would wear white lab coats, but the engineers would wear a jacket, collar and tie.
Wow.
So that was perfectly normal. And it wasn't for some years that rule sort of was broken down, really.
And just to explain to our listeners who maybe are not familiar with the recording process, the band are playing, the producer is the one who is in charge of the session, and the engineer is the one who's really, in my view, got the most pressure, because it's down to you to capture the moment, isn't it, basically?
Yes, absolutely correct. And in the early days, one had very little time to do it. At the end of a three-hour session, the producer would leave with the finished article. And very often that could be 4 songs for an album, or it could be 2 or 3 songs cut A and B side with one over for a single. So you had very little time to get it together. You had to be on your toes, basically.
Yes, absolutely. Any moments you remember in your career where you didn't get the moment?
Good Lord, no. Absolutely not, no.
I've got... I tell you what, it's just come flooding back to me here, Glyn. I remember in that very studio in Portland Place doing a session and the multi-track machine was rewinding and the room air conditioning had broken and something had gone wrong with the brakes of the machine and it suddenly... It stopped dead and the master multi-track tape spewed out across the studio floor in front of my very eyes. It just brought back a horrible memory there as I said that.
Oh, God, panic, yeah. I had that happen once on a Stone session and the tape actually split on the most minute angle across it over, I don't know, several feet, basically. And it took me... Oh, 2 or 3 hours to put it to splice it back together again, and having done so, I realised that I'd got the two pieces to take the wrong way around, and I had to start over again. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that is the woes of an engineer.
Absolutely. And at what point did you get into producing as opposed to just engineering?
Well, in the '60s, engineers didn't become producers. They were two completely separate.
Yeah.
Professions and it just wasn't ever thought of. I was working on the first Steve Miller album, Steve Miller Band, and mm-hmm. they'd come to England, and we'd been working for 3 or 4 weeks. We had 6 weeks to make the record, and Steve Miller himself was supposed to be producing. And after the first month, we hadn't got anything done. They were just sort of dicking around, really.
Yeah.
And so I got a bit frustrated, and I said, "Look, I'm not going to bother with this anymore. Nothing's happening, and I'm just wasting my time here." So he said, "Well, what do we need?" I said, "Well, you need a producer." So he said, "Well, would you do it?" And so that was how I got my first job as a producer. So we actually made that first album in 2 weeks. And
good Lord.
It was wonderful for me to finally sort of be let out of the cage, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you mentioned there hanging around. A lot of that, it would seem, went on when you were working with the Stones. They were legendary for hanging around in the studio a lot, trying things out for days on end. Would that be right?
Yes. Certainly as time went by with the Rolling Stones, sessions did get longer and longer, and in some instances, less and less got done. And I did find that particularly difficult to deal with, as anybody would, I suppose, after a period of time. I mean, obviously, the fact of the matter is that they still managed to make the most extraordinary records.
Yeah.
So it didn't have any hugely adverse effect on the end result, but it was pretty painful sometimes getting there.
Yes.
In the end, I wanted to get on and produce more myself, so I stopped working for them and cast myself adrift, which turned out to be not a bad thing in the end. Yeah.
Now, I read the list at the beginning there. If you don't mind, I may be out of order chronologically here, but I'd just like to do it to talk about a couple of the incredible albums that you were part of. Led Zeppelin's first album. To have been in, I know that, I think you knew Jimmy Page already, didn't you? But to have been in the studio when that was happening must have been one of those moments that the hairs in the back of your neck goes up.
Without any question, that's an understatement.
Yeah.
It was quite extraordinary. Although I knew John Paul Jones and Jimmy Page really well, Jimmy and I had grown up in the same town. We'd known each other since we were teenagers. And I'd known John Paul Jones really well because he was the number one session bass player for many years, so I used to see him pretty much every day. So I knew Jimmy had rung me and said that he'd put this band together with John Paul Jones, and I knew it would be really good because those two were involved with it, but I had no idea what it was going to be.
Mm.
So I agreed to do it and walked in for the first session, and once they played the first four bars, I mean, I was nearly knocked out the room. I mean, it was just extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary.
And did that only take 9 days, including the mixing?
Yes, that's because they were very well rehearsed for a start-off. They knew pretty much what they wanted to do. And because of the quality of the musicianship, they were very easy to record. And, It was like falling off a log, really.
And, of course, John Bonham, legendary drummer, no longer with us. The drum sound that John Bonham and you created has gone down in history. He must have hit the drums pretty hard, John Bonham, I'm guessing.
Well, I mean, he was not only an astonishing technician, but he tuned his kit brilliantly. And, frankly, that's the key to any good drummer, really. They all have their own sound, which is peculiar to the way they tune the kit and the way they strike the drum, I suppose. And my job, I've always seen my job, is to capture that sound, not to sort of try and make it become something else. And with him, it was, again, it was a complete piece of cake, really.
Mm.
You just turn the mic up and there it is. I didn't do anything. I just recorded what he was doing.
Oh, bless you.
And,
and is it true that you came out of that session with your acetate, desperate to play it to somebody and say, listen to this? Mick Jagger wasn't interested in listening to it, and George Harrison was a bit unfazed by it all.
Well, yeah, I was terribly proud of the record, having finished it, because I'd never heard anything quite like it. And to be honest, I was quite proud of what I'd done sonically as well. So I wanted to... A few weeks later, we were putting together the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus TV show, and we had a production meeting to decide, amongst other things, what other acts would be on the show. So I took along the acetate I had of Led Zeppelin album to the production meeting to play to Mick to see if he'd have them on the show. This is before anybody knew the band existed, even.
Mm.
And we only got through a few bars before he told me to take it off and shut up, basically. I said, well, you know, they're going to be huge, Mick. You know, it would be a great coup for the show to have them on. Didn't want to know, but hated it, didn't like it. Okay, fair enough. And then one night on the way back from a Beatles session, George Harrison and I used to go home the same way. And we went past Olympic on the way home, and I said, look, just come with me to Olympic, because I want to stop off at Olympic on the way home. I want to play what I've just done with Jimmy Page. So anyway, he came, and the studio was free. I went into the room we cut it in at Olympic, played it to him, and he looked at me like I was potty, you know. He said, well, you know, you've made me get out of my car and come and listen to this, that sort of thing. You know, he didn't get it at all. It was really, really a huge shock to me, to be honest, because I thought that everybody else would get it the same way I did. But listen, each to their own. Everybody has different taste.
Absolutely. We talked about a hair on the back of the neck moment there, and I believe another one for you was certainly the recording of the amazing record Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who.
Yes, astonishing. Absolutely astonishing. And I've heard the demos, which were extraordinary, but when the band got hold of it and played it and I was recording it, it was probably one of the most exhilarating moments of my career, I think, hearing that coming through the speakers. They were just extraordinary.
And I think I'm also correct in saying that John Entwistle was a bit critical of that album, Who's Next album.
Yes, it turned out, I didn't realise this at the time, because of the nature of the material, it wasn't all typical Who material, if you like. And it required both John and Keith to take a slightly different attitude, and in some cases play in a slightly more conventional way, if you like, to suit the material, which I managed to persuade them to do during the course of making the record. In particular with John, it was to do with the sound. I felt I needed a bass sound with more weight to it than he would normally get.
Mm-hmm.
So, which he went along with, and he never complained or anything to me at the time. But it transpires thereafter, once the album had been released, he was unhappy with his bass sound, which was terrible. I mean, it's the last thing I would have ever wanted, but for anybody I work with. But listen, it was their biggest selling album.
So yes, it did all right.
He couldn't complain too loudly, really.
Not really, no. No. The story of your involvement you mentioned there with the Beatles is an interesting one. If you don't mind me just talking through the Let It Be thing, which seems a very confusing set of circumstances that you got involved in there. Let It Be was eventually done, as we all now know, or it depends on how you look at it, annihilated by Phil Spector. You did the original one of that. Was that supposed to be called Get Back, or am I wrong with that?
No, I don't think it was. I don't think anybody had a title for it at all when we started it, or even when I finished with it.
Right.
I don't know that an album title had been thought of.
Mm. And what's the story there then? So you'd recorded loads of songs for ostensibly this album, and what happened that it got changed so dramatically?
Well, the original idea was for it to be a TV show with in front of a live audience with new material. It was Paul McCartney's idea, and they were to make a documentary of the preparation of the TV show, so that there'd be two things to work on.
Yeah.
So, as it was live, literally, that's what we did. They sat around in the studio and played and sang live with a little PA in the studio. and I recorded what was going on while we were preparing, rehearsing for the what was to be a TV show.
I see.
After a few days, the TV show idea got shelved because it didn't go down particularly well with everyone else. So we ended up with a bunch of songs, really good songs, a documentary that was being made about something that wasn't actually going to happen.
Right.
And so we decided that we'd go into a more controlled environment. We were on a soundstage at Twickenham at the time, and we the Beatles had just built a studio in the basement of their offices, so we moved into there and got equipment from borrowed some equipment from Abbey Road to record it, and we carried on rehearsing the material. And what I was witnessing was these four guys who'd proven to be the most amazing producers of contemporary music in the previous sort of decade. They'd broken every rule sonically in the way they'd made their records and turned the whole thing on its head, sort of thing, in a very creative way. And here they were, back right where they started, sitting around playing. And equally, there had been a bit of discourse between them for a couple of days, which soon got resolved. But I was also witnessing them being having a bunch of fun together, actually.
Yeah.
And I was like a fly on the wall, if you like. And I thought, well, Christ, if this is entertaining me as much as it is, maybe the album should be like a documentary of an audio documentary of what I'm seeing here. So I strung together a few tracks with false starts and then joking with each other and just messing about and jamming little bits of old songs and stuff, just to show that they, in fact, what they are. They were a bunch of ordinary guys, really, you know.
Yep.
And put the idea to the band, and which was immediately rejected, which was fine, I didn't mind. And then some months later, having finished the whole thing in that environment, we shot it properly lit and everything to sort of give an end to the documentary. And then the whole thing was shelved while they edited the documentary. That we were then carried on and started to make Abbey Road, which they did over the next few months. And I don't know, some months later, I was asked to go back in by John and Paul and put the whole thing together, put my idea together. They changed their minds and they thought that my idea would work. And I came to realise fairly quickly that the only reason why they'd come up with that idea was because they'd lost interest in the whole project.
Oh,
so they gave it to me. So I went ahead and finished it, and it ended up on a shelf in the basement of Abbey Road. The band broke up, and John Lennon took the tapes, gave them to Spector, and Spector then did what he did to it, which I thought had absolutely nothing to do with the band at all.
Yes.
And frankly, I've never listened to it. I mean, I listened to the first few bars and took it off. I couldn't. It's awful. Absolutely awful.
How disappointing.
So my idea sort of went by the by, which is fine. It's okay, you know. Everybody. It's the way things happen. I don't care. I did get a couple of singles out of it, but other than that, it was a great experience, and I don't regret a second of it. It was really good.
Brilliant story. I'm a huge fan of the Eagles, and I wasn't aware that when you first saw the Eagles, they were basically trying to be a rock and roll band, and you weren't that impressed with them.
Yes. You know what? It's so weird. When you go and see a band for the first time that you're not familiar with, which obviously, as a record producer, you do all the time.
Yeah.
It's really awkward, and the environment can be wrong. The club I saw the Eagles in, for example, had about four people in it. The sound was terrible. It didn't do them justice, to be honest. And it wasn't until I got them in a rehearsal room some weeks later that I realised just how amazing they were. And that was just because they played me a song on acoustic guitars, standing around without bass and drums. And I heard the real sound of their vocals, which was pretty extraordinary. And that's when I got what they were about, really, or what I felt they should be about, anyway.
Yes. Amazing. Just to finish off with Glyn, I won't keep you any longer, but to say things have changed since the early days would be an understatement. We now have a situation, as you will well know, where people can sit in a bedroom with a laptop and have no contact with any other person or indeed the outside world, and A, call themselves producer stroke engineer, and then B, make a record. That contact was the important part of a lot of those records, wasn't it? The playing together.
It's not for me to pass judgment on what's going on now. Clearly, there are lots of advantages to that, which we needn't necessarily go into. Mm. But certainly, the way I worked is the way I still continue to work, and that's what gives me the pleasure out of doing what I do, and that is creating an environment for a bunch of people to play a piece of music together, which is an emotive experience, if you like.
Yeah.
That's shared between those playing it. And to me, that's what made that whole era of music, recorded music, so wonderful. And every now and then you'll hear a record that's similar, but now, but it's very rare.
Mm.
Everything's become far too clinicized for me.
Yeah.
And since music really is all about emotion, it's difficult to display that emotion in the way I'm talking about, in the method that you just described.
Yes. And it must break your heart, Glyn, as a man who has made pristine-sounding records over the years, to have them put on an MP3 and stuck through a pair of £4.50 headphones.
Well, it certainly used to break my heart. It doesn't anymore. Since I've made a decision some years ago that if I can't affect something literally, then there's little point in getting cheesed off about it. So you just have to go with the flow. Yes, it is terrible. But equally, you know, a lot of people in the 60s had terrible sounding systems in their homes with this one speaker on a bookshelf and another one on the floor or whatever. And they enjoyed the music still, so there you go.
Yeah. Well, for those who want to read more, the book is wonderful. It's called Sound Man, and as I said at the beginning, I'm delighted that you wrote it, and thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm sorry to quote an ABBA phrase, but thank you for the music, Glyn, because without you, we'd be missing quite a chunk of our lives.
Well, but very nice of you to say so. It's not strictly true, but anyway, bless your heart. It's nice to be on your show.
All right, Glyn, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.